But he added, quote, "When I examine the question itself and carefully consider Calvin's views, I seriously hesitate to say that he held that particular error," end quote. He cites passages where Calvin clearly asserts correctly in his view that the divine essence is shared from the Father to the Son, and that the Son was indeed begotten by the Father. All this, Bellarmine says, was undertaken not in order to defend or excuse Calvin, quote, "who by all his heresies has made himself unworthy not only of the defense of Catholics, but of their company as well," end quote. It is done rather to show that there is no use wasting any effort on the issue, as it is in fact no real issue at all. As to the other factors measured, referring now back to Table A on your handout, the other factors, we find that out of the 1,674 times that Bellarmine does present Calvin's view in the controversy, he cites specific work of his from which the view was taken 1,346 times, or 80%. Calvin is quoted directly 429 times, which is 26% of all citations, better than 1 in 4. These percentages are high in both cases and are a further reflection of Bellarmine's high standard of care in his use of Calvin. What are the specific works of Calvin that Bellarmine makes use of throughout the controversy? Table B of your handout lists each work mentioned and the number of times it's cited. Bellarmine makes 1,401 total citations to specific works of Calvin in the controversy. There are 36 different works of Calvin involved, works of all kinds, systematic theology such as the Institutes, small treatises or polemics on specific subjects, and scriptural commentaries. Bellarmine had a wide array of works to choose from, as Calvin was indeed a very productive writer in all areas. From the Corpus Reformatorum edition of Calvin's collected works, excluding letters and sermons, one can count about 100 different works of Calvin that Bellarmine could have recourse to as he was composing the controversy. He does cite 36 of those 100 or so, or about one-third, which is a fairly impressive amount, considering the often very specific subject matter of many of them. Thus, in this regard as well, Bellarmine's use of Calvin is thorough and careful. Though 36 different works of Calvin are cited, there are only two of them that are cited more than 20 times. These two, the Institutes and the Anecdotes of Trent, between them account for 88% of the 1,401 total. The Institutes, of course, has far more than any other. It utterly and completely dominates the field, its 1,122 citations constituting a full 80% of the whole. Calvin indeed did write many individual works on specific subjects, but through it all, he still remained a man of one book. The Institutes was more important than all his other works combined. The others contained little that sooner or later did not find its way into the Institutes in its essential form. The work is a systematic and detailed treatment of all aspects of theology that were in court at the time. It includes not only presentation and explication of the Reformed point of view, but presentation and refutation of opposing points of view as well. Thus, it is both expository and controversial theology at once. Bellarmine, as a defender of Catholic and a refuter of Protestant doctrine, could thus be attracted to it in two ways. It gives and argues for its own view on every point of doctrine, and often presents and refutes the Catholic opinion on the matter as well. No other work of the time in Europe could compare to it as a ready, concise, and complete source of Reformed Protestant doctrine, argumentation, and controversy. It is a work that no writer purporting to refute Protestant thought could possibly ignore, and ignore it, Bellarmine certainly does not. The only other work Bellarmine cites at all frequently is the Anecdotes of Trent. Why Bellarmine would be attracted to this work is obvious. Calvin there attacks the decrees of the Council of Trent. This is something which Bellarmine, as a Jesuit, a Tomist, an Italian partisan of the papacy, and a loyal defender of the cause of Reformed Catholicism, could not allow to go unchallenged. One of his main motives in the controversies is to defend and advance the theological settlements of that council. Time and time again throughout the work, he begins his exposition of the Catholic point of view he is to defend on a given subject with the citation to the appropriate decree of Trent. And in the controversy on council, he lists the Council of Trent as the 18th fully authoritative ecumenical council of the Catholic Church, which as such contains nothing that is not approved by the Pope and that can be rejected from dogma by Catholics. The other major Protestant foe in the controversy, the Lutheran Martin Temmin, is one who also wrote a refutation of Trent. Besides the Institutes and the Anecdotes, not one of these 34 other works of Calvin cited is is referred to even as often as 20 times. This is understandable given the fact that so many of them concern only specific and very restricted subjects. It is more to government's credit, in fact, that so many of them are consulted at all. Thus, government's treatment of Calvin and his thought in the controversies is in general truly commendable. He is consistently scholarly and accurate in his citations of Calvin's views. On two occasions, he even comes to Calvin's defense against fellow Catholic writers who attack him wrongly. What errors he does commit are negligible acts of omission and oversight, not overtly malicious. The favorable reputation that Bellarmine has always enjoyed in regard to his fairness to his foes is shown to be based upon a solid foundation in fact, and to be truly well deserved.
If that tradition is reconstructed in its historical integrity. and its idiom understood, not under the categories of the schoolmen, but in terms of its own pattern and usage. The following discussion has to do with the idiom of monastic cultural life as a context of Lutherzilla development. It will attempt to identify and characterize the religious language Luther encountered in the Augustinian cloister, to understand this language in relation to a specific study, the structure of monastic life in the late medieval cloister, and to suggest how Luther's early thought describes the vocabulary that for Rough Culture is related to the dynamic and historical sense of the monastic tradition. Perhaps the first point we met in the attempt to reconstruct Luther's encounter with religious language is to recognize the existence of a distinctive and identifiable monastic style among the religious idioms of the late Middle Ages. Point has been established by recent studies in medieval religious history, studies covering the range of exegetical, speculative, and devotional literature, and challenging the notion that scholasticism, in whatever version, governed the cultural life of medieval monasticism. It has further been possible to see the outlines of a theological tradition, if not unique, at least common among the writers and teachers of the Augustinian order, a tradition Father Zumkeller has characterized as a kind of affective meditation, and known to Luther through such authors as Simon Fadaccio Concha, Jacob Parez, John Pauls, and of course John Stowers. A second point is that this monastic style is highly traditional in character. It has a structure and a set of meanings which have persisted over a long period of time and maintained its essential features in terms of usage and custom. It appears, therefore, in the late Middle Ages as a long-standing cultural structure whose internal parts and relationships have been remarkably stable and consistent. Don LeClaire has sketched how large elements of the monastic vocabulary and experience were set down as early as Gregory the Great and given distinctive medieval shape by the scholar Cairn Lynch's revival. The flowering of the monastic style was the work of the spiritual writer of the 12th century, and a recent study by Giles Constable has demonstrated the widespread appeal of these 12th century concepts in the 14th and 15th centuries, as evidenced by the number of manuscript versions of the earlier writers. The point holds for the Augustinians. The masters of religious life in the late Middle Ages are the spiritual writers of the early Middle Ages. There are clearly defined movement in the 14th century to reject scholastic influences in favor of a return to the earlier medieval writers. As to the forms of the monastic tradition, Don LeClaire has described a wide range of literature produced by the medieval cloister. Our interest in the active day-to-day traditions, however, draws attention to the primary routine of the medieval cloister, the Opus Dei and Lectio Divina, and to the literature ordered by the rounds of liturgical services and prayers, and serving as an extension of the sacred readings and meditations. This devotional literature shares what Heusinger calls the tendency of medieval thought to crystallize into visual images, in which spiritual attitudes and practical concerns are represented by the exemplary behavior and gestures of a heroic figure. The gospel narratives themselves provide a framework for much of this devotional tradition, as these were refashioned by the medieval cloister into a kind of heroic epic, extended narrative centered around the lives of Jesus and his followers. Early versions of this, of these devotional lives of Christ, may be found as early as the 9th century, but the best known and most widespread versions are the large lives of Christ of the 13th and 14th centuries, put together by such authors as Rudolf of Saxony, Jordanus of Quedlinburg, and Simon Fadaccio of Prussia, whose De Gestis Domini Salvatorius was to be found in the library of Wittenberg. These works are heroic in that they center upon the exemplary deeds and actions of primary figures, an epic in structure, in being organized into separate and distinct scenes which become standardized and arranged in fixed patterns. The language of the narrative is direct and simple, serving the dramatization of the action, not the explication of its meaning. Towards the end of the Middle Ages, devotional attention became increasingly fixed on the scene of the passion, with countless sermons and artistic representations drawing upon the mastic staging of the scene. The bulk of the devotional writings of Luther's immediate Augustinian contemporary drew directly upon these words. John Paul, for example, who was responsible for the Studium Generale in Gerber Cloister of 1605, refers to Simone Fidati as the most profound of medieval spiritual teachers, and draws large elements of his sermonic and devotional work directly from Aetius Pistonius, or John Stowitz, who in his Nachfolgen des Studium Sterben Christi of 1515, sets down his understanding of religious experience in terms of an effective imitation of Christ in the scenes of passion. Telling the tale has a didactic and devotional purpose. It is a heroic paradigm offering dramatic representations of exemplary behavior and attitude. It entails the staging of typical figures, teaching appropriate modes of behavior and attitude by word and example. John Stoppel's puts it as follows. On the hill of the Calvary, he has shown us a model of all sanctity. He is a model given by God, according to which I would work, suffer, and die. He is the only model which man can follow, in which every good in life, suffering, and death is usefully modeled. Therefore, no one can do right, suffer correctly, or die rightly, unless it happens in conformity with the life, suffering, and death of Christ. To a man, the cultivators of this tradition warn against using it as the basis of theological speculation. The tradition itself is damaged by the attempt to abstract a meaning. This feature of the monastic tradition has been obscured by a tendency in modern scholarship to force an artificial separation between the contemplative and active elements of monastic culture. The core of the monastic tradition, even in its contemplative aspects, remains a behavioral and effective tradition. An essential part of this literature is a clearly prescribed set of responses on the part of peers and leaders. The basic rubric here is imitatio, an imitative or better mimetic response further specified in two ways in the literature. Imitatio effectus pulcherus, the external imitation of the deeds and gestures of the narrative, and imitatio affectus mentis, the internalization of appropriate attitudes, emotions, and self-awareness. The two modes of imitation are interrelated. The external gestures both represent and shape internal attitudes. The kinds of responses are clearly and extensively spelled out, and these are familiar enough. Obedience, self-denial, humility, contrition, self-contempt. The point here is that this catalog of virtues is presented to the community as part of the Christological epic and as the appropriate response to its telling. At its center, therefore, the monastic devotional tradition prescribes an identity or a fusion of the knower and the known. The content cannot and must not be separated from the mechanics of its reception in the behavioral, in behavior and the subconsciousness of the hearer. This point cuts across the wide range of monastic literature and is an essential mark of the monastic style, appearing in forms of theological meditation, the styles of mysticism, and an exegetical emphasis upon the tropological or moral sense of the biblical text, always the dominant meaning for the monastic commentary. The sense of monastic language is in the talent, in the dynamics of active performance and the mimetic response. This prior to the thematic content. Much of this tradition of language, therefore, relates to its traditionality, to the concern for the mechanisms by which it was used and maintained within monastic groups over a long period of time. If this much is a fair description of a core of tradition alive in monastic communities in the late Middle Ages, it remains to locate this language more precisely in its historical setting, seek to identify the conditions of medieval monastic life which govern and explain the pattern and usage of devotional language, and in which this language may be understood as an active and essential element. The first point here is obvious and yet perhaps the most important, is that monastic communities are, in a unique sense, language-based communities, heavily dependent upon the authority and reception of language for internal cohesion and survival. The main work of the monk, the work which defines him in his culture, is the opus dei, the performance and cultivation of sacred language. The structure of the community is identified by reading the rule and continually reinforced by the daily readings at meals and chapels. Moreover, and this point is often overlooked, the primary contact between members and their tradition is an oral contact. Most monastic devotional literature was composed not for a private literary meeting, but for an art, but for an audience. The Vita Christi tradition bears clear marks of this. There are repeated references to hearers and to listeners. The themes are described in vivid language, using the repetition of key words and phrases designed to fix the models in the mind of the audience. This condition of language preservation means that the essential elements of the society, its rules, structure, and practical knowledge, must be cast so as to be effectively communicated in the public setting and easily remembered and responded to by hearers. Thus, the form of a linguistic tradition in this situation is intimately related to the maintenance of social cohesion. From this, it is readily apparent why Vita Christi's epic, with its dramatic and vivid figure and its capacity for mimetic response, arises as the dominant linguistic pattern in monastic culture. The tale is an exercise in social identity and an essential one for the survival of the community. A similar correspondence between devotional language and its social setting may be observed in relation to the structure of authority. The rules of the monastic order contain clearly drawn lines of authority and give clear direction as to the modes of the exercise of authority. The constitutional authority of the abbot is most pronounced, of course, in the rule of Benedict, which pictures the cloister as a school of servants under the direction and discipline of the master. In its constitutional function, the figure of the abbot merges with the divine figure of Christ, Benedict writes. Because the abbot is esteemed to be in the place of Christ, he shall be called Lord and Abbot. The mode of authority is twofold, by word and by example. The rule reads, when anyone takes upon him the office of abbot, he has constructed disciples in two ways. That is, he is to lay before them what is good and holy, more by example than by word. To teach the law of the Lord by word of mouth, the such as are of quick comprehension, and by example to those of harder hearts and meaner capacity. Hence, language and example are the medium for the exercise of power in the maintenance of social order. This corresponds precisely with the ways in which the primary figures present themselves in devotional literature. With the constitutional changes of the observance movements of the 12th and the 13th century, the personal rule of the abbot recedes before the increased importance of liturgical collaboration and detailed uses and customs. A development which only reinforce the role of the Christological epic in the exercise of political authority in the monastic community. The rules are clear as well about what may be called a code of behavior. The code breaks into two parts, external actions and gestures, obedience, silence, service, and inner attitudes, humility, self-denial, hate of self, and the love of others. Moreover, this two-part code is based upon the capacity to respond to the language and example of the public model of authority, to imitate them through words and deeds. Thus, the condition for social cohesion and order is a kind of linguistic sensibility, the capacity to identify with and imitate words and gestures, precisely the same linguistic sensibility which governs the performance and reception of monastic devotional literature. What emerges from these considerations is the striking identity of devotional literature and the constitutive order and social structure of monastic groups. Devotional and constitutional literature share a common vocabulary because the usage of religious language is embedded in the social structure of monastic communities and in the conditions for social cohesion. These conditions dictate that the cultural tradition be cast in the forms of heroic narratives and received by way of mimetic identification and imitation. At stake in the telling of the tale and in maintaining the mimetic spell of of their reception is the very cohesion of the community. We may now turn to the question about the relevance of these observations for understanding Luther's development. In what way does Luther's early thought relate to the idiom of monastic devotion and to the dynamics of language usage within monastic culture? The pattern which seems to emerge from this kind of analysis is twofold and corresponds closely with Luther's external relations with his order. He himself tells us that up until about 1518, he fully embraced the monastic life and toiled for the interests of the Augustinian hermits as teacher, preacher, and administrator. The monastic usage is fully present in Luther's work from this period, informing the main features of his early sermons and lectures. The real crisis in Luther's relation with his order came in 1518. Only then did Gerhard Hecker, the Augustinian province general in Saxony, brand Luther as, in his phrase, in rebellion against his religion. Studying Luther's thought from this phase, between 18 to about 1521, in the context of monastic devotional usage, only seems to underscore Hecker's judgment and suggest that the emerging Reformation ideas involved an assault upon monastic usage and reception of language, and hence upon the mechanics of monastic cultural survival. First, some brief illustrations of how Luther's earliest work is grounded in the language of monastic spirituality. The recurrent theme of these works is, of course, the divine word, meaning, authority, and impact. As in the monastic tradition, the word is the medium of the sacred. Nothing exists apart from the word, whether history or experience. Further, the only valid encounter with the word is an internal encounter. This from Sermon 1514. The word is twofold. The primary word is internal, which is the only genuine word. If it is spoken in your heart, then it is the word, and the perfect word, because you know by experience. The spoken external word is incomparably inferior and weak. The form of the word for Luther is Christological, and emphasis in Luther entirely consistent with the monastic tradition. Gerhard Abeling, for one, has shown how far Luther goes in weaving the words of the song, the chord of the Opus Dei, into the Christological scene by way of making Christ the speaker of the song, an extension of a monastic exegetical and devotional practice. The figure of the suffering Christ is the verbum brevum, the Greek word, in another place the summation of the sacred and eternal word, phrases and themes which are abundant in the Vita Christi literature. Further, the young Luther requires his hearers to relate the sacred images in didactic and devotional ways. They are images to be imitated in external action and inner attitudes and self-awareness. From a lecture on Romans, whatever is written about Christ is written for our learning, that we might imitate him. Hence, we should not accept what is said about Christ in a speculative way, but as an example for us. All of Christ's deeds are our instruction. Therefore, the narrative or history of these deeds is always intended for our learning, because this image contains everything. The Christian life is an imitation, conformity to the Christological paradigm of, in terms of, external behavior and internalization of attitudes and self-consciousness, things wholly consistent with monastic usage, and things which continue to find expression in Luther's protest against the status of indulgences. The 95 Theses, you remember, opens with this: the whole life of believers should be one of penance. Christ is not restricted to inward penance only, for inward penance is nothing unless it produces outwardly the various mortifications of the flesh. By 1518, new themes are evident. Themes which, when examined with reference to monastic usage, can only be understood as designed to destroy that usage and as a sustained assault on the delicate structure and cultural mechanism of the monastic tradition, at points using the very content of monastic language against its traditional usage. This may be specified, again too briefly, in terms of a brief look at how three themes from this period work together to undermine the linguistic sensibilities fundamental to Manassas culture. First, the word becomes primarily an external word, its sense clear and precise, a word which means independently from the processes of its reception and internal version. The significant confrontation is now with a text, with its literal and grammatical sense, or with a promise, one with clear and unambiguous historical and contextual references. The word of external promise replaces the word of meditation and inner experience. Correspondingly, Cale told about the suffering Christ has lost its didactic and devotional point as a primary meaning, and has acquired a theological meaning, one which can be abstracted from the narrative. The Christological drama is relocated in history, and its meaning defined not in terms of the modes of its reception, but in terms of a statement, a testimony, about divine intentionality. It is instruction, for example, on how to read the gospel narratives from 1521. Luther explicitly rejects the use of these as examples, and insists that their reading be lifted out of a network of imitative responses and located in the past, from which their meaning as statements, as testimonies, may be discerned. Quote, there is besides the still worse practice of regarding the Gospels as law books, in which is supposed to be taught what we are to do, and in which the words of Christ are pictured to us as nothing but examples. The Gospel is, and should be, nothing else than a discourse or story about Christ, just as happens among men when one writes a book about a king or a prince, telling what he did, said, and suffered in his day. So such a tale is a past, like any other story about Christ, as Luther here literally prescribes, is to undermine the very purpose of its telling in the monastic usage, and to render it powerless as an instrument of social cohesion. Thirdly, the concept of faith emerges, which is defined not as the processes of internalization and receptivity to language, but as the perception of meaning and the capacity to disengage experience from perception. Luther's first formulation of this is his insistence that salvation is always notes, extra notes, detached from the behavioral and psychic responses of the believer. The monastic fusion of knower and known, believer and believed, the foundation of the spirituality of Innocentio Christi, has been broken, and the workings, if you will, of the monastic culture is short-circuited, transformed into an ideology. The central motif of the ideology is the dialectic which emerges of religion and faith, a dialectic which breaks any psychic identification with the Christological imagery, and works the alienation of language in its meaning from the perception of its from the experience of its reception and usage. In 1521, in his introduction to his treatise on monastic vows, Luther explained that he was held in the monastery for 16 years by being, quote, led astray, seduced by the various usages of words. The foregoing analysis has taken this statement literally, and sought to understand how Luther's thought involved a transformation in the usage and reception, more than the content, of a linguistic tradition. A transformation whereby the dramatic figures and deeds of the heroic narrative were frozen into theological meaning.
About the concept of monastic languages as an element of social cohesion. day-to-day working out of what I think of as social cohesion. How is it, what is it exactly mean by that? I mean, it must be more than people hear the same words all the time.
The ways in which they learn appropriate behavior and attitudes which are conducive to the internal cohesion of the community are modeled in the literature which is used in the monastic tradition, which is read in the meal, which is read in the chapel. There's an exclusive and identifiable vocabulary which is both in the literature of spirituality as well as from the rules, in the rules of discipline. And so what is said in the rules in more formal, legal way is modeled in terms of exemplary postures, deeds by the figures in devotional literature. And it's that correlation which seems to me to document how the literature is used to, as it were, socialize into the structure of the community. I can give you an explicit example of how this is going to work for some time. This is a fairly minor point, but this is a quote from the Rule of Benedict. A monk's inward humility is indicated by his posture. Wherever he may be, he is to look down with bowed head, inclinato discomfort capite, conscious of his guilt, imagining himself ready to be called to give account at the dread judgment, right? A picture of a monk who is humble, who walks around with a bowed head. Right, this is what appears then in the Vita Christi tradition. I'm reading here from an example in the 12th century, but it appears in all of the things that I read, including Paul's as a section on this. Right? But now is morning, and he is delivered over to Pilate. So the picture is seen before Pilate. Their charges are brought against him, and he says nothing. Mark well how he stands before his government, his head bent, and the exact phrase is used, inclinato, in both texts, his eyes cast down, his face serene, saying little, ready for insult and scourging. The parallel is almost exact in terms of so what we're talking about is attitude and behavior being socialized in the meeting of the monastic devotional community. And it's that correlation in vocabulary which is what I'm talking about. There are other examples, there are other ways to do it.
Yeah. It seems to me that what you're saying to a great extent was there was some kind of conscious rejection in the monastic community.
Yeah.
What about the relationship to the monastic mystical tradition, where he published, for example, in 1516, I think it was, the Theologica Germanica. How do you fit this one?
His relationship to the mystical tradition has been re-examined in Osmond's book primarily. What happens evidently is that he begins to read those German mystics in 15, while he's doing his lectures on Romans, in 15, 16, 17. Very enthusiastic about what he's reading, and he does comment. By 1519, he's turned his back against that whole tradition, and he rejects his early enthusiasm for the tradition. Now, it seems to me that what the mystical literature that he reads is a kind of intensification of the sort of meditative, effective reception to divine language, which is a part of the monastic tradition. So it conforms to the pattern that I've outlined since there was a transition around 1618, if I can figure it out. At that point, then he loses into the poor mystical literature. I think Stephen Austin reads that wrongly when he makes the distinction between Luther and Power in those notes in 1516. I think he's reading into that something which doesn't become crystallized for Luther theologically until later. And it wasn't involved. The linguistic sensibility is more than a theological position, which is identified.
Can I take a follow-up question with Mr. Kirchner? Isn't a lot of what you say also a pattern seen in Erasmus of the elastic in the top 50 and so on? Could it partly be a reaction reading Green's article on Luther, Erasmus, and Melanchthon in current church history? And there seems to be a conscious give and take between Luther and Erasmus, and perhaps some of this rejection of the monastic might be in part of rejection of Erasmus going on at the same time. In 1518 and 1519.
I really haven't done very much with Erasmus. My impression is that Erasmus has been closer to the monastic tradition than has generally been, but I think that's really, I don't think that's
pretty good. I'd like to ask kind of a follow-up. I think the earlier question, as I understand what you're saying, Luther takes a monastic tradition and turns it inside out in many ways. So the word, instead of being internal, is external, and so on. You extend this to the question of social order and discipline that was raised earlier. If this was an element and indeed an indispensable element of social cohesion in the monastic tradition, does Luther continue to turn this inside out?
What I think is happening is that, there are a couple of guesses here, and the level of guesses in a sense. What I think Luther is doing is working out an intensely personal relationship in his discipline, in his own commitment to monastic discipline. When he later on is confronted with the problem of social order, which he is when he comes back to Wittenberg in 1522, it seems to me clear that he draws upon some of the things that he rejects in that truth study of 1518 and 1521. And so he confronts it not really in the monastery, but in the town, where he has to return. And then he does draw upon monastic piety as a way of their dealing with social order and disorder. And so I see the phase from 1521 as a rather idiosyncratic phase, in a sense, like for his development. And that, I don't want to call it inconsistent because that sounds pejorative, but that combination of things from in Luther in his later career, I think, is difficult. At times he can use the monastic spirituality in addressing certain kinds of situations in terms of the sermons. On the other hand, it's very clear that he didn't lose the sharp sort of external word and dialectic of words in faith, for example, in the Galatians, much in 1531 to 1535. There's very clear that what he defined 1518 remains as an element of his thought. So the answer is definitely yes and no. Most of what John Colt does draws from Simon Padati, Lawrence Gaddafi is a friend, is a Augustinian, an Afghan Augustinian, with close associations with spiritual Franciscan. Franciscan is a 14th century case. His is put together in the 1330s. However, I think it draws, and up to this day, I don't think anybody located that, it draws almost plagiarizes an earlier document which can be found in the British Historical Monument, which draws upon Cistercian priors of the 12th century, allegorizes the most important about there. So I use the 13th and 14th century, the 12th to the 14th century, rather sweepingly, because in terms of the literary tradition, in fact, you can do that. There's very little change in the context, except for the flowering of this open Bible in the century. The codification is very large. You get Christian beautiful fractions on the 500 or so folio volumes, folio volumes. But they are elaborations, seen very highly, rearrangements. But Bernard quoted extensively. And so, you know, there's no real gap there that will be. Many Augustinian treatises, supposedly Augustinian treatises, which the Augustinian order in the 15th century said, what they returned to us, like that standard, in fact, returned to the sermon of the father, the Pope, and the doctor.
Yes, I was just wondering, you speak of a break with the spirit of monastic literature and monastic oral. But Luther does continue to regard St. Bernard very highly, even after
1815. I think if you read it, no, I don't believe he does. He rejects much of that literature.
Well, then that answers the question.
There are points at which he does use that literature, no point there out there. But it seems in terms of the reception of that language, the critical point about the fia infusa, the Greek language, he rejects that point very hard. He rejects the kind of internal aspect of spirituality consistently after 1522. Yeah? Even though he uses then Bernard's critique of scholastics usefully and consistently. It takes parts of the tradition.
Sure, then you can reject the spirit by conscience.
I think. And what I'm trying to argue that makes it less a theological dividing line, less it is just a theological divide, and it is the much more subtle thing of the usage and the experience of believers in the tradition, the relationship between consciousness and conscience, which sharpens the
I wonder if you could share a general idea on Luther, you see a significant difference between monastic and non-monastic study process and so on.
It would not care a general idea. I've generalized much too good.
Let me say, way of establishing the importance of this ingredient in Luther.
Yeah, let me say that I'm not sure how many, well, many of Luther's most ardent supporters who've been preaching the city, further recognition of cities are last month got to somehow understand and immediately respond to the notion of faith that have articulated. And I think that's a link. On the other hand, I think many of his immediate followers don't quite appreciate the significance of this formula of sola fide, because they haven't undergone this kind of encounter with internalization of language that Luther had to go through, and against which that formulation has therefore significant meaning. But I haven't really taken it down Luther. And I really began with this problem in Luther. And I would like to generalize more, but I really wouldn't just do this book.
I'd like to address a question to Bob Rickles. Bob, you mentioned that government corrects some Catholics who had attacked Calvin. Does government ever give any credit to Calvin for defending certain doctrines against the radicals, which Calvinists and mainstream Protestants would have held together with Catholics? For instance, the tractate against the soul sleepers, against Gentile, the letters of the Paul. Does he at any point praise Calvin as a polemicist in his common concern?
Yes, he does. There's a whole, this is an abridgment of my full categorization of what I actually did the whole thing, but there is a whole category of citations where Bellarmine cites Calvin on his side against common enemies, mostly the radicals, and a number of, I think a number about 60 total in the work. And they come mostly in the treatise on baptism and against the Anabaptists. And a number of times he will even go so far as to say, such and such a radical has said this, but Calvin has already so well refuted him in this place, I won't have to say any more.
What about the claim about the Lutheran Reform thing? Does he use Calvin against the Lutherans and vice versa the Lutherans against Calvin?
He doesn't intend to do that, no.
Well, what if you took Calvin's writing and applied the same method to it? What would you find?
What specific factor do you mean?
I wonder how out of line with the ordinary polemical method Bellarmine's use of Calvin is.
I have a impression that in Calvin he would find much less gentlemanly. That's the one thing.
So how about if you use the same statistical approach and took how many times Calvin is inaccurate and used the source? Do you have any other find?
No, I don't do. I don't have any. I really don't want to venture a statement on that, because I think in order to really understand the really universe well, you have to do it. So I have done.
I wonder if you might speak a little more on what you feel is the significance of
take it out of Calvin and set it up as if it were a formal statement according to the Scholastic, a formal proposition according to the Scholastic usage, and then he will refute it. As far as going beyond that, I don't know what to say on the prison of that, but I would just say that I think it's just the basic Scholastic method that he uses or insulates him against being personal and Protestant controversialists than there is among Catholics. And that's something
And not going to our leading for production of relationship between objectivity and client.
There are sort of limitations to this collapsism, but it's not all an asset. I mean, there are limitations to it, too, because at times she does miss innuendos in Calvin, which if he weren't so collapsed, perhaps he would have seen. But it has assets and it does have its liabilities, but in this particular issue, it has its assets.
Do you think this is a more effective method than being in a context of religion?
Well, Bellarmine was effective, or at least he was popular, let's say, and there was his works were quickly translated and the editions multiplied. He immediately gained a reputation among Catholics as being the man to go to when you had to answer a Protestant. Many Protestants themselves, when they read the book, despaired because of its erudition and its length, and rumors were circulating about how could this be the work of one man? There must be a whole legion of Jesuits behind this, you know, developing itself couldn't have done it all. I think it was effective, yes. He certainly got a reputation as the leading controversialist.
And it comes not so much? Yes, well done.
Well,
I was going to say it comes not so much from his learning as his objectivity and learning to be honest.
Yes, I think so. And his completeness, too. Extremely complete. I mean, he covers everyone. Pretty well.
Does he spill over from strictly doctrinal concerns into criticism, let's say, of the social aspect, political aspect of Calvin's teaching of that of the corner? Or is it strictly dogmatic in the realm of dogmatic theology?
What do you mean by it? You mean he's about implications in the social implications in the Protestant doctrine?
Yes.
Well, he will talk about Calvin as preferring aristocracy as opposed to monarchy. But again, he approaches it in a propositional sense. He doesn't go on and say, therefore, look at the Calvinists, how they behave. He's not inclined to draw those, what we would call, practical conclusions from it.